the Chief Judge and the Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. We're delighted to be sitting here today at Marquette University Law School. The court calls United States v. Plant. Counsel for the appellant, please.
May it please the court, Philip Cave and Jonathan Legg.
Can you speak a little louder into the mic? And if you're in the back row, will you jump up and down in a frenzied manner if you cannot hear? Speak softly, and then let's see if they actually do that. Okay, please.
I did. May it please the court, Philip Cave.
We're good in the back? Okay, good. Thank you.
And Jonathan Legg for the appellant, Staff Sergeant Plank. Plant. I've asked to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if the court is willing to do that, Your Honor.
Granted.
Thank you. Your Honor, Your Honors, excuse me, did Sergeant Plant physically endanger his child? That is what we believe is the proper question that you need to be answering in regard to what effect, if any, his alcohol consumption had on the night of the alleged incident. And I ask you to think about it that way because that's what the government committed to do at trial. At trial, there was a pretrial motion to dismiss this very charge and specification for essentially some of the same reasons that we're here to talk about today. And during that session, the military judge and trial counsel had a discussion about the nature of the evidence and what is it they were or were not trying to prove. And trial counsel, perhaps in response to the military judge, agreed that what they were really intending to prove was physical endangerment.
How are you defining endangerment? Must there be actual endangerment, possibility of endangerment?
Your Honor, the manual for courts martial itself and the military judge instructed that we're looking to a reasonable probability of harm. And when you think about that, Your Honors, I would ask you to consider that when you put the word reasonable or reasonably in front of something, that should be a word of limitation. And that goes to the issue, and it sort of ties into the issue here, which I am pointing out to you, is a lot of what the government argues to you relates to mental, or the potential, the possibility of mental endangerment.
Well, counsel, this is a legal sufficiency case.
Correct, sir.
And of course, the problem with legal sufficiency is that it's a pretty low standard or high standard, depending on how you look at it. Are you saying basically, which I think you have to be saying, that no rational trier of fact could have found that this child was endangered? Physically endangered, well, you know, this child was endangered because the manual speaks of endangerment.
Sure.
It speaks of culpable negligence, and then it speaks of endangerment.
This court looks at the evidence. This court examines the evidence favorably to the prosecution. And yes, as you have just stated, that's where we're at. Yeah, I agree. I'm looking for a legal argument there. But no, we agree, Your Honor.
And your position is that no rational trier of fact could have found that this child was in your words, physically endangered.
Physically, yes, Your Honor.
Physically.
And yeah. you're making the case that the argument stuck with the theory it presented at trial.
That's correct. And essentially what I'm saying, although we did not argue it explicitly in our brief, that essentially when the government talks in its brief at JA 6 and 14, I believe, it is essentially arguing a new theory. Again, we should have been more explicit in the brief, but certainly I think...
the new theory is that by committing an additional crime, the child was being put at risk. What's the new theory you said the government's presenting on appeal?
Sure. In the sense that the charge allows for mental and or physical. That's what the sample specification allows for, and that's certainly what was charged here in the beginning, and that's certainly how they proceeded. But the government limited themselves to that portion of the charge specification in the manual, the elements of the offense, which in fact went only to physical harm or physical endangerment as opposed to mental. And I think that gets to another point here.
I thought that the charge only charged welfare. The element in the manual is that you can't endanger the safety, welfare, and physical and mental health of a child. But when you read the actual charge, the only one they chose to proceed under was welfare.
Yes, Your Honor, and what I'm arguing is physical welfare. In other words, you can have a child's welfare. I agree. You can have an umbrella form of welfare, but the way that the...
Well, the terms that the elements as set forth in the statute are different, and if they have welfare and then they also have physical and mental health, aren't those different? I mean, isn't welfare something different? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what welfare includes here.
Sure.
And it sounds to me like the argument at trial was that it included everything.
Yes. Ultimately, when you got to, the judge gave the standard instruction, and certainly when trial counsel argued at trial, it was a sort of an umbrella. It was an umbrella approach, and it was Phillips and Judge Ryan's point is, I thought as I first read it, the government's argument is they were trying to do what Judge Ryan had said in Phillips, which is you have to have some evidence, or at least when you get to argument, you have to present a theory, and you have to tie that, you have to connect the dots. And that's what was missing. But that certainly, in my view, in reading the record of trial and their briefs, is they're taking an umbrella attack. But in reality, I would argue, am arguing, that at the time of trial, when they did the motion, they were stuck. Now, unfortunately, the defense later on in the trial did not object when, in my view, the government went outside the bounds.
It's still not clear what they were stuck with, in your view. Were they stuck from arguing, as they did on appeal, that committing crimes in the house, other crimes in the house, put the child at risk?
Two answers. One is yes, and number two, that's irrelevant to this particular, to the facts and circumstances of this charge. That gets into, it becomes irrelevant to what, as I see, talking for the appellant, as I see, is it's completely unrelated to whether or not that child was in any danger, frankly.
Well, counsel, why wouldn't it be the case, given the standard of review and given that we look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the government at this point in time, right, that there is evidence that the appellant was the sole parent there, correct?
Certainly, yes.
Right, but let me just finish, right? The mother was not in the home, right? Just the father was in the home.
That's correct, ma'am.
Looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the government, the father was extremely drunk, right? I understand there's evidence that he wasn't as drunk, but we're looking at it in the light most favorable. he was inebriated and incapable of caring for the child.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right, and at least he never specifically asked anyone else to look after the child.
Right.
Right? And at some point in time, he certainly was not engaged in caring for the child because he was sexually assaulting two women, right? So why, under that, couldn't that foreseeably result in harm to the child, even though that's not the natural and probable consequence?
Well, my argument is no, Your Honor. And I would add this, if I may. There is evidence in the record that, in fact, he was not neglectful of, that's not the right word, but neglectful of the child, because you have testimony from witnesses that at various stages during the evening, he asked them to be quiet. He asked them to be quiet because he did not want them to wake the child. That evidence is some consciousness of taking care of the child. Secondly, Your Honor, there is testimony at JA 290 that from at least one witness that on various occasions he went back. He was occasionally going backwards and forwards to the. Apparently, there's no direct evidence that he did it, but certainly there is. Some evidence here.
Well, and I, Counsel, I agree with you that if we were looking at the evidence that they could have, right, certainly chosen to acquit him, or if we were looking at the evidence in light most favorable to you, that all of those would be salient points. But so, what do you do about the evidence that I talked about?
Well, I certainly agree with you, Your Honor, that when you go back to deliberate yourselves on how you want to decide that case, these are, in fact, some of the facts that you can consider. And I agree, they may appear to others to be hard facts against my argument.
Well, let's consider them and pretend we are considering them. How do you respond? Take a seat at our conference table and tell us what the counter argument is. If this person was highly inebriated, why is that not endangering the child, or why is it?
Well, because that's only one step of the evaluation, Your Honor. There is more to it. There has to be a connection.
That's what we're waiting for you to fill in, please.
Well, that is my point, Your Honor. There is no evidence that the child was in danger. We have the possibility, or at least some evidence, that the
child... So you're arguing, in effect, there is no reasonable probability of harm.
Yes, that's where I'm headed. Yes, Your Honor.
What if he were passed out on the floor?
Same thing, Your Honor. In this case, same thing.
Because of the other people, because JM was there and sober, or because the child slept through the night, why, if someone is completely passed out, does that not create a reasonable probability of harm?
In a different case, it may do. Not in this case, Your Honor, because those aren't the facts. A parent who is alone with no other person in the house, not committing any other crimes, who gets so drunk and so insensate that they can't even take care of themselves, then I can see that might be in a different case, an argument for why in a different case the evidence would be legally sufficient.
Okay. And this is sort of post hoc ergo propter hoc in that you've got, you know, the next morning you have an unharmed child.
Yes.
Okay. Therefore, no harm came to the child.
Right.
Therefore, does it follow that there was no endangering circumstances? I'm following up on the Chief Judge.
Right.
What do you want us to take from this argument? Simply that the physical circumstances, what the appellant did,
right,
what the others in the house were doing, that he told them to be quiet, that he may or may not have gone back and checked on the kid. Basically, is what you're saying is that the all of this put together, even viewed in the light most favorable to government, does not constitute physical endangerment, which is necessary to prove the government's case beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you for making my argument, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's where I'm headed.
Okay. You tie it together for us?
Well, again, the next step is that the dot you've got to connect is that, yeah, he may have been blotto, drunk, okay, not knowing what is going on. But that's what's absent is how does that connect and how does that affect the welfare or the safety of the child? And that's what's missing here. There isn't a connection between, that's where I think the government fails as well, is there isn't a connection between just the fact of being drunk and what is really the danger. On the facts of this case.
Well, what if the child had, and I understand this didn't happen, but what if the child had started to choke? What if the child had needed to go to the emergency room? I mean, there's a litany of things that could have happened, even though they didn't happen. And
yes,
how
sir.
Could he have dealt with that?
And that there's a litany of speculations along the same way in the government's argument, Your Honor. I agree, but I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Please finish.
Okay. I agree with you, but this is a normal circumstance, Your Honor. In other words, Hurricane Sandy, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people stranded, some of whom may have been drinking. Are we going to say that under those circumstances, they're guilty of the crime of child endangerment? That's where I think the government, and I think I'm still answering the question, but...
We'll cut you off, don't worry.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that's where the government is taking undue license, frankly, with Clause 3 prosecutions in general and this Clause 3 prosecution in specifically.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Ron.
Any other questions? We can have more questions on rebuttal. Thank you very much. We'll now hear from Amicus, please.
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Joshua Bryant, and I'm speaking on behalf of Amicus Curiae and arguing in support of the appellant. We believe this court should set aside the appellant's conviction for child endangerment for two reasons. First, the MCM's explanation of culpable negligence should not be used to relieve the government of its burden under the UCMJ to prove that the appellant's alcohol use alone endangered his child, LP. Second, the government failed to show a causal connection between alcohol use and any harm to LP. Under Article 134, the government was required to show that the appellant endangered LP's mental or physical health, safety, or welfare through culpable negligence by his use of alcohol.
And you would agree it's potential harm or actual harm?
Potential harm, Your Honor. And the government was free to charge that sexual misconduct, permitting drug use, or even allowing strangers into his home was a basis for child endangerment. It chose not to do so.
So you're arguing that the government's locked into the theory it presented at trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the question is, how big is that theory? The government might argue the theory is the proper, improper use of alcohol led to all the other things.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why don't they get that theory? Why doesn't that count as the theory? Why are they stuck with just the inebriation?
I think the problem that arises, Your Honor, is that if we base appellant's conviction beyond the alcohol use, then we're resting his conviction on conduct that was never charged as a basis for child endangerment. And if we do that, it's only going to encourage prosecutors to allege alcohol use, prescription drug use, or even non-prescription drug use any time a caregiver was consuming those types of substances. And then it could be used as a catch-all that the prosecutor could turn back to the record and base a conviction on any marginally connected activity, even if it was never alleged as a basis for child endangerment. And I don't mean...
It's alleged here, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is it not alleged that the use of alcohol endangered the child?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so what you're really doing is you've got a parade of horribles out here, but that's not this case.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's a policy argument. Maybe it should be directed to the legislature.
Understood, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to suggest that the appellant's other activities are immune from consideration. I only believe that the surrounding conditions should be considered within the parameters of the alcohol use. So to the extent that they showed his level of impairment or his inability to care for his child, they would be relevant, but I don't believe they do so in this case. The government's theory at trial or court-martial was that the appellant was an opportunist who took full advantage of the situation. They should now be able to go back to that same record and say that that exact same conduct also illustrates that he was incapacitated and unable to serve as a caregiver.
What would have had to happen in order for there to have been child endangerment in this scenario?
In this scenario, under alcohol use, I think you'd have to look at something either. You'd have to have either the amount of alcohol consumed, if the individual was drinking in front of the child, or as the court suggested, if Sergeant Plant had passed out and was actually incapacitated as a caregiver.
So you're saying drinking in front of a child could constitute child endangerment?
I believe it could, Your Honor, depending on the level of intoxication, and you'd have to consider the other factors, such as the age of the child. I could see how it would be damaging to a child to see their parent incredibly intoxicated.
If you were a judge and you were writing a case to try and distinguish between bad parenting and child endangerment, what principle of law would you espouse when it came to alcohol?
I believe, Your Honor, you'd have to have those factors that I suggested. You'd have to have something that is actually pushing some type of causation, some type of harm on the child. And that kind of turns me to the second point, that the government failed to show a causal connection. You'd have to have something there that raises that level, that increases the probability of harm, not just drinking in and of itself, specifically in this case where it wasn't in front of the child. If we do that, then this situation is no different than any parent that comes home and has a few too many beers or a few too many glasses of wine after work. The only question would be the level of intoxication and their ability to care for their child.
Well, I mean, and that's kind of what this case has come down to, right, which is how drunk does he need to be, right? Because you're saying if he was passed out, then that would be enough. But whatever his level of inebriation was, if that wasn't enough. And I wonder how you distinguish between those two points on a relative scale of sobriety or lack thereof.
I think that's the difficult question.
We're not talking here about someone coming home from work and having a couple of glasses of wine, right? I mean, if you look at his own testimony, it sounds like he was having two or three drinks per hour over a period of many hours.
Correct, Your Honor. And at this stage in the proceedings, we would have to assume that as the case.
Right. And so what's the distinction in his ability to care for a child between that level of incapacitation and being passed out?
Well, I think the obvious distinction is that if you're passed out, there's no ability to care for a child. The Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals even stated there was no reason to believe that the appellant wouldn't have been able to pick up a phone and summon help had a situation arisen. And I think the real danger that this case presents is that we weren't looking at those surrounding circumstances as a basis to determine the appellant's level of intoxication. We were looking at them as a separate and distinct avenue. The Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals stated that alcohol use and the circumstances surrounding the alcohol use could have foreseeably caused harm to LP. I don't believe that the court ended up using those surrounding circumstances to illustrate the level of intoxication. It used those surrounding circumstances to create a separate and distinct avenue that was never initially charged as a basis for child endangerment.
Are you arguing spillover?
Yes, Your Honor, essentially.
Okay. In applying the any rational trier of fact standard, should we apply it any differently in a case that involves judgments about parenting? Who's our rational trier of fact? Is our rational trier of fact someone who is a parent? Is it someone who isn't a parent, or does it matter?
I think it would have to be a parent, Your Honor. Because I think only a parent could speak to what type of care is necessarily involved in raising a child.
Doesn't that turn the standard on its head?
I don't
argue it on the one side, on the other hand, and tell us where you come out. What's the argument for why we should adjust the standard, and what's the argument for why we should not?
I believe the reason you would want to consider the reasonable trier would be a parent would be the fact that only a parent knows the level of care that would have to go into taking care of a sleeping child. If you have a 13-year-old child, I don't have children myself, but I would imagine if you have a 13-month-old child and that child's sleeping through the night, you wouldn't disturb that child absent a reason.
What's the argument on the other side?
that the, I suppose it would simply be that the standard shouldn't change regardless of the particular charge that's before the.
And counsel can present the issues, any facts that are necessary.
Correct, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
But can't you have an expert in this area who does not have children, but has studied the area all their lives and probably is more aware of the intricacies of the area than any parent out there? Why does it have to be a parent?
I suppose you could, Your Honor, but I don't believe there's any reason to have such a complicated approach.
Well, actually, it's a complicated approach requiring that it be a parent, limiting it in that fashion.
Understood, Your Honor. I think that the problem with this approach is that it does take what should otherwise be a simple specification and charge, and it makes it very complex by looking at all of these additional factors surrounding the neglectful conduct rather than the neglectful conduct itself. And there's no question that alcohol use is often a contributing factor in child endangerment cases, but it's not the alcohol use itself that endangers the child. It's usually the conduct that's surrounding the alcohol use.
Well, counsel, isn't the problem in this case, I mean, just at the bottom line, is that, you know, the members were in a position to make the distinction between bad parenting and criminal culpability, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Right, and so, well, we could quibble about whether this was a inane charging decision, given the other things that they had. At the end of the day, weren't the members in a position to make that distinction?
I believe they were in the position to make that distinction, Your Honor, but as I previously mentioned, I think the danger is along the lines of a spillover argument that they could have got caught up in the conduct surrounding the alcohol use rather than the alcohol use itself. And as counsel mentioned, at the hearing on the motion to dismiss the child endangerment charge, the government acknowledged that under its approach, even if a parent was consuming alcohol 500 miles away from the child, they could still be considered culpably negligent in that respect if the parent, for example, forgot to pick up the child from school. My point is that it's not the alcohol use that endangers the child, it's the failure to pick that child up from school. If we had a parent that was golfing 500 miles away and that child happened to be diabetic and didn't receive their insulin, we wouldn't say that it was the golfing that endangered the child, it was the failure to provide that insulin. And I think that's what happened here. We had the alcohol use, but we actually, the conviction rests upon non-charged conduct, the appellant's other misdeeds that night, not the alcohol use.
Is there a key fact you wish to bring to the court's attention, in your view, that might be dispositive or not?
No, Your Honor.
I just want to clarify one thing. You were earlier talking about the degree of negligence. Is it your argument that there was no negligence here or that there was no culpable negligence here?
I think you could certainly make the argument. I would say you could even make the argument in both respects that there was negligence here and perhaps even culpable negligence. My argument is that if there was culpable negligence, it arose from conduct that was never charged as a basis for child endangerment. Any questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government, please.
Thank you, Chief Judge Baker. Judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Thomas Alford, along with Colonel Catherine Oler. We represent the United States in this case. By his own admission, appellant was severely intoxicated the night he sexually assaulted two teenage girls in a room only a few feet away from his sleeping infant son. Using a plain English meaning of the manual's definition of culpable negligence, and considering all of the evidence presented at trial in a light most favorable to the prosecution, a reasonable fact finder could, and indeed did, find all the elements, essential elements of child endangerment beyond a reasonable doubt.
What do the sexual assaults have to do with it?
Your Honor, I think, what Mr. Cave said and what Amicus discussed, and I think it's an important point in this case, is those circumstances surrounding the neglectful conduct. I think they're relevant if you look at the definition in the manual that the president enacted essentially in October of 2007.
Well, say he committed the same sexual assaults and hadn't been drunk.
At that point, I don't think it's relevant, but the manual makes it relevant because the manual says that you can consider the circumstances surrounding the neglectful conduct.
Now you lost me.
How is the child endangered or potentially endangered?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How is the child endangered or potentially endangered in this case?
I think Judge Ryan pointed out a few of the potential.
I'm looking for the government's answers, not Judge Ryan's, but go ahead.
We would share some of the hypotheticals that Judge Ryan pointed out, but for example, if the child needed feeding, if the child needed medical attention, there was a point in the night actually where appellant was there alone. The folks that were at the party all left, and he was there alone, and thankfully they came back, and that was one safety measure that was there. The government will acknowledge that, but viewing this evidence in the light most favorable to the government, appellant's own admission, he told this to the police, was that he had 2 to 3 drinks of hard liquor an hour, and in a light most favorable to the government, the longest this party was about 7 hours. You do the simple math there, and we're talking about 21 drinks. Now, even if you don't look at those circumstances surrounding the misconduct like the sexual assault, and I think that's marginally relevant because, again, the definition of the manual brings that in, but even if you don't look at those surrounding circumstances and you look at only the alcohol use alone, which the trial counsel did argue, by the way, in closing argument, she said that the alcohol use is what impaired his judgment and made him make all of these really, really stupid mistakes for a staff sergeant to make. If you look at that alcohol use alone, that is itself legally sufficient to sustain this specification.
Well, again, what's the reasonable probability of harm to the child? The possibility that they might have to drive somewhere in the middle of the night? What are you saying the reasonable probability of harm to the child is?
Well, we're talking about a 13-month-old, as Your Honor knows, so there are a number of things that a 13-month-old is dependent upon his caregiver to provide care. Food, if the baby started crying in the middle of the night, if the baby needed medical care.
The reasonable probability of harm is the child might get hungry? I mean, what's the harm part?
I think if we go to your opinion in Vaughn, Your Honor, and we talk about the Airman First Class in that case left her baby, essentially, I think it was a younger baby, it was only 2 months old, in the crib, and she went and partied for 6 hours and then came back.
In an entirely different location.
But we're talking about
a case that required child neglect finding rather than child endangerment, though.
That's correct, Your Honor, but essentially the same elements. But in this case,
Child neglect doesn't require reasonable probability of harm.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that a very significant difference?
I think that it is, Your Honor, but even in that case, the definition was still culpable negligence was the definition provided. But if I could draw the Vaughn analogy, is that she was gone for 6 hours.
Culpable negligence and endangerment, doesn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct.
So culpable negligence without more doesn't get you there.
The government would agree with that, Your Honor.
I'm trying to figure out, in the off chance that there may be more than one airman who drinks to excess while having children in the house, how do we distinguish between the airman who is drunk with children and the airman who is drunk with children and committing a criminal act? And how will they be on fair notice that they're now moving across the line of bad parenting to crime?
Well, I'd like to address that. There are two, with regard to the parade of horribles, I think there are two circuit breakers, if I will. And one of them is the standard of culpable negligence, which is a higher standard than just negligence. And the fact finder has to make that determination that it was basically a willful disregard to the foreseeable consequences. So that's circuit breaker number one. Number two is also the terminal element. Just because somebody maybe has a few glasses of wine at home, in the light, and this is from the definition of the manual, in the light of human experience, members aren't going to find necessarily that is service discrediting conduct. Now, when you add in the fact that there are other folks doing cocaine there, that there's sexual assaults going on, all these things that stem from impaired judgment, then you're gonna have what we have in this case. And so I think in the charge and in the definitions in the manual are built-in protections.
Well, let's go back here to endangerment. And I think we're all agreed that that's defined in the manual. It's to subject one to reasonable probability of harm. And we've defined that term, reasonable probability of harm, in many other cases. And we say that it requires a substantial likelihood of harm, not a conceivable likelihood of harm. And it seems to me that almost everything you're arguing here that is a direct impact from the intoxication is conceivable. It might have happened. It might have happened. How do you deal with that definition, and should we not adopt that definition for this case?
Well, Your Honor, I think that you should adopt just the language that the President put into effect from the manual. And I would say that endangerment is a somewhat of a concurrent standard in addition to the culpable negligence standard, because one talks about...
We have to read them both. We have to look at them both. I don't think you get to culpable negligence until you get past endangerment.
I think if you look at just the plain meaning of what reasonable probability means, and then also, as I alluded to, culpable negligence talks about foreseeably result in harm, which may not be the natural and probable consequences of such acts. But going back to reasonable probability of harm, bring up U.S. v. Gutierrez, which was a case this court recently decided. That case, you looked at the language actually that contained in the statute said likely, and likely could mean greater than 50%. In this case, the plain meaning of reasonable probability of harm is that it's a probability, it's a possibility, it's something that could happen.
Probability and a possibility are two different things. A probability seems to imply more than 50%.
Well, I think
if it's probable, then isn't it likely? Doesn't it seem to be more than 50%? If it's possible, it can be anything. And then you've got to figure out what reasonable is. But if it's a reasonable probability of harm, and that, you know, it's got to be fairly far over toward the certainty factor, doesn't it?
With respect, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think reasonable probability means it is something that the members can, you know, that they can, it's something that's tangible, that they can hang their hat on, that it's a probability, it's something that could happen. If it said likely, I would agree with you, but this is reasonable probability. But even if it is more likely than not, even under that standard, I think that appellant was lucky. Being this intoxicated for that amount of time, not just 6 hours, because the alcohol, as you well know, alcohol continues, the effects of it continues on for multiple hours. And he actually did pass out. He did fall asleep at some point in the night. So the child was lucky, but even if you use a heightened standard, in this case, looking at this case with a light most favorable to the government, the government would assert that you could still find that this charge is legally sufficient.
So you would say that there was a substantial likelihood of harm in this case?
Even under that standard, although that's a very high standard and one I don't think that the manual requires, but even under that standard, yeah, I think the government would say that that is indeed the case, Your Honor.
So, counsel, if you've got a 13-month-old who has no physical or developmental issues, you're saying that there's a reasonable probability that any child in that position is going to experience harm on a specific night?
Well, when you go back to the definitions, that the definition from the manual and then the instructions provided by the military judge that corresponded to that definition, when you're looking at all those other things that came in that night, and I think that's probably where the relevance comes into play the most, all the other things that happened that night, yes, I think that there was a substantial likelihood that there could be harm. This child was mobile. 13-month-old, this is not a 2-month-old like in Vaughn, who couldn't move, who when she came back from the party, the child would still be there. This child potentially could have gotten out of the crib. There was cocaine in the next room. There were people coming in to see the child. There's testimony all throughout the record that they were going.
Which way does that cut? There are people coming in to see the child, i.e. the child is being looked at.
Well, if you look at the testimony of appellant, I shouldn't say testimony, but appellant's own admission, he said this to the police officer, and this is on page 444 of the joint appendix. He said, they, meaning the young girls, were in the bathroom doing coke. The police said, okay, what was your response to that? And I just said, okay. And at one point during the night, I took all the girls into Luke's room so they could see my son. I think that cuts very much against appellant when you had a bunch of young teenage girls who were high on coke, one who later took out a knife and was banging on the door. When you add all of this together, this is why the definition in the manual is crucially important.
There's a gathering of people, and there's a baby in the house, and there's no cocaine, and there's no drinking. Don't you think it would be reasonable for them to say, can I take a look at the baby? And he took him in there. The baby wasn't awakened. He cautioned them several times to stay quiet. I don't see how that cuts in your favor at all.
Under those circumstances, Your Honor, I could see that, yeah, maybe that would not rise to the level. But again, this is a totality of the circumstances approach, essentially, when looking at the definition in the manual.
How can we know that all this other stuff, the sexual assaults, the drug use, didn't spill over into this? Or can we not know?
I don't think you can know for sure, Your Honor. And it's important to look at this.
You seem to be arguing it doesn't matter, or that the language of the manual compels it.
If this court finds that it matters, it would matter. But even if this court, even if this court doesn't look at those other factors, it doesn't look at the circumstances surrounding neglectful conduct, then we still look at the alcohol use. But looking at, if this court does adopt the manual's definitions, which this court has said are persuasive, that the president has put forth, then I think it wouldn't matter as far as spillover goes, Your Honor.
Is there any special way we should be looking at the term any rational trier of fact in this case, in case of child care?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think so, Your Honor. I think this court can still apply the standard from Jackson v. Virginia. I don't see anything in this case that would make it a case where you'd need to apply a different standard for legal sufficiency. Court members are eminently qualified to make these sorts of decisions. I just want to point out just a few other portions of the testimony I think is relevant, and I know this is a factual type analysis here, so because it's legal sufficiency, but if this court would grant me, I'd like to point out a few points. For example, on the joint appendix on page 64, SS says that appellant was not in any condition to take care of his child. MJ, his own friend, said appellant would not have been able to take care of his child. That's on page 109. And then on page 102 and 122, there's the testimony regarding the young lady who ended up taking out a knife. And then the only sober person, who was JM, during this whole time, she testified that appellant never asked her to look out for his baby. So, again,
did she also say that she was willing and able to step in if the need arose?
She did, Your Honor, yes. And as the Air Force Court pointed out, too, I mean, ostensibly he could have made a phone call as well. But I don't think that changes the analysis because he was the sole caretaker. He was the one charged with responsibility. This young girl didn't have any obligation to take care of the child should something happen. And as I pointed out, at least for that portion in the night where everybody left, it was just the appellant and his young child.
Counsel, if the government prevails, what is the appellate principle of law that will be established in your view?
Your Honor, I think consistent with Vaughn and then consistent with the manual's definitions, I would say that this court should just simply adopt that and allow these sorts of more difficult factual questions to be resolved by the members who, as the court said in Jackson and as this court said in Oliver, are the ones who are really best to kind of sort through all of these details. So if there are no further questions, if I may briefly conclude.
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appellant's conviction for child endangerment by his use of alcohol is legally sufficient. The evidence introduced at trial, when viewed in a light most favorable to the prosecution, easily provided the fact finder with sufficient evidence to conclude that appellant was culpably negligent by using alcohol excessively. This alcohol use impaired appellant's judgment so substantially that it was reasonably foreseeable his infant son could suffer harm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, you have opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So we have the government in the position of advocating that essentially helicopter parenting needs to be enforced through the criminal laws. That's what they've argued, and that's what this case in some sense is about. Now, some people might say that that's a policy argument. As we know, sometimes the courts effect or set the policy, and I think that's one of the things that, big picture-wise, I would ask the court to have in its background. And I think part of what you need to be saying is, and this somewhat goes to the issue of Phillips and Vaughan and Miller and Premiller, that the court ought to say in some part that the use of alcohol is not per se evidence that you have endangered a child if there's a child around. That's sort of what they're saying. If you joined the Navy when I did, we had functioning alcoholics. We still have functioning alcoholics in the world. So this is a partly an absence of proof, if you will, because, yeah, we've heard statements about how they thought he was, but there's no evidence that he was stumbling around, that he was fighting. Fighting, for example, Judge Olson in front of a child while they're drunk, that might be something, because the child might be in physical danger of being kicked or hit or fallen or something. Even there, I would argue that the evidence to his alcohol level and the effect of that alcohol is itself ambiguous on the facts of this case. And I do take and understand the idea where you could have a person, whether it's a parent or not, who's alone with a child and gets so drunk that they really are.
But ambiguous or not, we're going to construe those in the light most favorable to the government.
That's correct, so that's Your Honor. That's correct. That's the standard for this court. I absolutely agree, Your Honor. I'm tracking where we're at on that. I think I'll leave it there unless you have questions, Your Honor. Any of you?
Sorry. I don't believe there are further questions. Thank you, counsel. The court thanks both counsel, the amicus as well. And we are now going to stand in recess with the clerk calling the court. After that, we'll then invite you to please retake your seats, and we will open up the bench for a question and answer period. And during that time, you can ask questions of the judges or of counsel. The ground rules are, though, no asking questions about the case or disguised questions about the case. And we sort of caught on after a while what is a disguised question, so we'll see. Anyway, if you could please.
All rise. The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.